Jesus has entered Jerusalem, fulfilling all the prophecies. He has been hailed as king, even if it's superficial, even if they will not continue to hail him as king. He has for the moment been hailed as king, and next day he clears the temple of all that commercial trading. A den of robbers compared to the house of prayer that it should have been. He's given that demonstration, really, of what Israel is like in the withering of the fig tree that he curses. Israel are like that withered fig tree. And he's been traveling back and forth to Jerusalem. And as he arrives another time and is teaching in the temple, the chief priests and the teachers of the law came and asked him about his authority. And he answered them about that, questioning what they thought about John, putting them in a corner about John, because of course if they accept the authority of John the Baptist points to Jesus, they have to accept the authority of Jesus. And we thought about that last week, and then the parable that Jesus told of the tenants who wanted to get rid of all the servants that the master sent, including the son of the master, and the judgment that would fall upon them. And they realized that that parable is said against them. And the questioning continues here. The chief priests and the teachers of the law, it would seem, are the they, in verse 13, who sends some of the Pharisees and Herodians to try and catch Jesus out. I think that they are the they who sent these people to them. It's really an alliance, if you put it all together, of the absolute who's who in the political scene, in the religious scene, in Jewish politics, and in religion. And they come to Jesus with what you can clearly see is a tricky political question, a question to try and discredit Jesus. And they begin with great flattery. Teacher, we know that you're a man of integrity. You can almost hear the sneering way in which they say it. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Of course they don't believe that. Otherwise they'd be hailing him as king themselves and saying, not by what authority do you come here, but what do you want us to do, great king? So of course they don't really think he's a man of integrity. And of course they don't really think he speaks the truth from God. But that's just a bit of flattery to lead them in to their question. And the question comes very quickly. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And then slightly more aggressively, should we pay or shouldn't we? Ooh, tricky question. People often say nice things about Jesus, but they don't really accept him as king. You hear people say all kinds of good things about Jesus. He was a great man. He was a great teacher. He was a great example. He was a great role model. I'm sure he existed. People will say all kinds of nice things about Jesus, but that doesn't mean they accept his authority. So we need to be aware of that. We need to be aware of it for ourselves. We can say all kinds of nice things about Jesus and kind of mean them at a superficial level, but that's not good enough. We need to accept his authority. But from those weaselly words, they bring forth that question. Judea, that particular area, it's Judea and there's Galilee and so forth, but the area where Jesus is at the moment became a province of Rome about AD 60, and there was a census taken, and they imposed a tax per head. What's often a tax per head is called a poll tax, and there was this tax that the question is about. All taxes are painful, aren't they? And those of us of a certain age will remember the poll tax riots. Quite an unusual thing for sort of political riots. There have been various kind of regional riots in towns over the years, particularly during the summer months where people have got nothing better to do. But the poll tax riots was quite unusual because it was a real sort of marshalling of people kind of against Margaret Thatcher because she wanted to impose a new tax, which was basically per head. So it was called a poll tax. So it wasn't peculiar to Margaret Thatcher. It's just those of us remember the poll tax as being a Margaret Thatcher thing, but it just means a tax per head. And it was painful for all kind of normal reasons for the Jews, but it was especially painful for a couple of particular reasons. It was painful politically because it was a sign they were under Roman control. You imagine if we had not won the various wars. We can't beat them at football, but at least we can defend our country from various attackers. And imagine we hadn't won and we're occupied by a foreign invader, of course, nothing against the Germans, but it would have been the Germans in this case. And imagine we're occupied by the Germans and the German authorities are the ones that are levying a tax. And we have to pay a tax to the Germans, and maybe they're Deutschmarks that we're paying to them. Imagine the political feel of that. It's a kind of reminder every time you pay your tax, every time you have to go and register, that you're under authority of a foreign power. So politically, it was really painful paying the tax. But religiously, it was really painful as well, because it meant God's people were under a foreign power. But more than that, it meant that perhaps in some way you were supporting the emperor cult. You remember that sometimes while the emperors were alive, they were considered gods, but certainly when they died, they were considered kind of beautified in some way. Obviously passed off into the Roman Catholic Church to some degree, but they were considered special and maybe gods when they died. And that whole emperor cult, god cult, was really symbolized by these coins. And it meant that you might be supporting that whole cult of the emperor being God and the fact that God's people are under these idolaters. Could you really do that and still be God's people? So it was a really clever religious political question. And it's the perfect trap for Jesus. And they kind of want to set the same sort of trap. You remember, it was a bit of a trap, although we thought of the reasons why, that Jesus set them. John's Baptist, did it come from heaven or from men? That was a kind of a question like that, and they were trapped by that. They couldn't answer it. And maybe they hoped, yeah, we've got Jesus with this one. We've got a question just like his, where we're going to trap him, and he'll have a little conferring with his friends, and he won't have a clue how to answer. Because the trouble with the possible answers are this. If he says no, don't pay the tax, he's a rebel. And the Herodians, interestingly, who are sent in this little group, the Herodians, as you can imagine, because of the Herod connection, the Herodians pretty much supported Roman rule. They were kind of a part of it. So they could immediately grass him up to the Roman authorities, and he'd be branded a rebel, and they'd get rid of him. They could accuse him of being a revolutionary. There were plenty of them around. Plenty of them who got arrested, people like Barabbas, who gets freed instead of Jesus, you remember. So maybe he could have been labelled as one of those. As if he says, no, you shouldn't pay taxes. But of course, if he says yes, then he's being unpatriotic and maybe sacrilegious. The Pharisees, you've got the Herodians, you've got the Pharisees. The Pharisees can say and lead the people to think he is just not patriotic, and he doesn't really accept that God's people are unique and special and need to be distinctive. They could say all things against him because of that. And we see that Jesus sees right through it. But Jesus, verse 15, knew their hypocrisy. He can see that it's not a genuine question. They're not genuinely inquiring. And so he says, why are you trying to trap me? Doesn't really want an answer to that question, but it's just putting it out there to show that he understands what they're trying to do. Why are you trying to trap me? Why would you want to entrap the king of the ages? Why are you trying to trap me? And then he says something surprising. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. Bring me one of the coins and let me look at it. The tax was, from what I've read, a single silver denarius. That was what the tax was per head. And one of those coins is produced. And Jesus asked the question, as you saw, whose portrait and whose inscription is on this coin? And the answer is Caesar's. The coins were for payment and they were for propaganda. So they obviously had some value, but they were also kind of publicity. I was reminded in kind of reading up about it again that before a couple of hundred years ago, really, the only way that you knew what your monarch, that's the word, looks like, was probably through the coins. So, you know, you imagine you're a dairy farmer in Haywards Heath, and you don't get to visit art galleries and stuff. What does the king or queen look like? You don't have a clue. The only inscription, the only picture you've got about them is your coins. That's how you get to know how they look like. That was interesting. Let's just think about that. And that's how they would know, vaguely, what Caesar looked like from the coins. Because it had a picture of Caesar Augustus. And the inscription would have said, Caesar Augustus Tiberius, stepson of Augustus. And in words, it would say something like, it was abbreviated, which was interesting as well, to think how they abbreviated Latin. But anyway, son of the Augustus high priest. Kind of abbreviated, but that's what it was saying in around the edge. Son of the Augustus high priest. The father of the current emperor had been deified already. But on one side, you had the current Caesar Augustus. On the other side, you had Livia, who was probably a goddess. There's a bit of dispute whether she was a goddess or whether she, in fact, was the wife of the emperor. But most people seem to think she was a goddess. So that's what they would have described. But the summary was, whose inscription, whose picture, what are the words about? They're about Caesar. And we wonder what's coming next. Of course, you know what's coming next because you just had it read to you. And you probably read the story 20 times in your life. But it's still really fascinating, isn't it? What is Jesus going to say then? Because he's really trapped. You know, he's got the coin. And you think, what's he going to do with the coin? Is he going to pay? Is he going to hand it over to somebody? And the answer, which is, of course, brilliant, is this. Jesus said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. Stunning. Stunning answer, so much so that they were all amazed at him and not really sure what to say. That's what happened. Got two lessons, really. See if you can guess what they are. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. And give to God what is God's. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, the first point. Jesus says, there is a realm of responsibility towards those who rule over you. So give to Caesar what is Caesar's. What was Caesar's? Well, Caesar's was the empire. They were the ruling power. They'd been ordained by God. They were there by God's providential purpose. So they're there. They're the rulers. So give them what they deserve as rulers of your country. Extract tax. Extracting tax is one of the things they're doing. It's a necessary part of operating that society. So give to Caesar's what is due to Caesar's. Whilst you're under Roman rule, you need to pay your dues. And that's a general principle that Jesus speaks about there, which of course carries into the New Testament. So for example, I'm sure you're familiar with Romans chapter 13. I thought I'd found and now I've lost. Romans chapter 13. And really the first few verses of that. But it's kind of an expansion of that general principle about giving to Caesar what is Caesar's. And probably the Caesar that Paul is writing about here is an even worse Caesar than the Caesar that was around in Jesus' time. The emperor was much worse. But Paul still says, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. He wants to make it clear, they're established by God. They're not very nice, but they're established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he will commend you. And then just jumping down towards the end. This is why you pay taxes. For the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. Give to Caesar's what is Caesar's. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. So I suppose the lesson is pay taxes, pay what is due to people. But of course, it extends beyond paying our taxes, which I hope we do. I hope we don't do anything to evade paying tax that we rightfully should pay. So we need to pay taxes and to pay it cheerfully, not grudgingly, and to accept that although we don't necessarily, as people who live in the South, and half of you probably voted UKIP, probably don't want to be ruled by Europe, we have to accept that at this point there are some rules that come from Europe and we respect those. And we honour those people that deserve our honour because of their position, because they're put there by God. We may not like the decisions that are handed down. We may not feel they deserve our respect, but they do deserve it because God has put them in place. So we pay our taxes and we pay our respect and we serve and we act as good citizens. It seems to me that there's not one appeal in the New Testament for revolution or for revolutionary behavior. Of course, there's a call for radical behavior. Of course, there's the principle that if we're called by our government to do something which is against conscience, that we shouldn't do it. We obey God rather than man. But there's not one call to say, well, if you don't like your government, overthrow them. Because that's not really a kingdom priority, is it? And I think for us who live in a democracy, it kind of makes us scratch our head a bit and think, what does that actually mean? Of course, it means paying taxes and it means paying respect, but I think it also means that we have to engage. It's a bit of a buzzword, engage, and I don't like using it particularly, but it means we have to get involved with the process of government. At the very least, I think, we need to vote. We need to vote because we are part, in a sense, of the authorities that are instituted by God. We have a system where we have some say. I know it's frustrating that sometimes we feel we don't influence things very much and our vote doesn't count and everything, but it's kind of part of our giving to Caesar what is Caesar's, that we participate. And we participate in local government and local organisations and local initiatives to try and make the country better. And I think that's part of us giving to Caesar what is Caesar's. And that becomes increasingly difficult as we become a more secular society, doesn't it? We're getting more and more closer, really, to the kind of governments that were in place for the early church, where they were opposed either passively or actively to Christianity. And we're getting closer to that, and that makes it harder to work out how we participate and how we respect. As Steve mentioned, we've got a visit from the Christian Institute on Tuesday. And it's hard to work out whether everything they say and do is right as the Christian Institute. And sometimes you kind of wonder about some of the stories they run and some of the other things, the campaigns that they run. But as a matter of principle, we want to support the idea of trying to engage with government to do good, to influence for good, because we are a democracy, and it's in a way part of our giving to Caesar's is that we engage and try and make better laws than worse laws. We try to make laws that don't end up murdering people. We want less people to be murdered than more people, don't we? So we try and influence because God has given us that authority as voters, as participants, as people who can write to our MPs and so on. So give to Caesar, what is Caesar's? I think it just struck me as well that it opens up a more general point, which is, does the teaching of Jesus have an answer for everything? Well, I suppose it depends what you mean by everything, doesn't it? But it opens up the general point that this is a religious political question, but it's kind of a question that people would have been talking about around them. And although perhaps there isn't a specific Bible answer to every question you might be asked that's political or religious, if you've got a Christian mind, if you're soaked in the Bible, I think there pretty much is an answer to everything. The kinds of things that your mates are talking about as they go about their daily business, the kind of political, religious-y kind of questions that are around, there should be a Christian view on them, shouldn't there? Because all wisdom is God's wisdom, and there's either a direct command or a principle or a matter of exercising wisdom in God's world. Now, we don't have the great insight of Jesus and that great ability to bang with a question that completely nails it, but we do have the mind of Christ. We do have the Holy Spirit dwelling in us, and we need to be ready to give answer on a whole range of issues. It's worth thinking about. You know, what are your friends going to be talking about at work tomorrow? Is there a Christian worldview on any of those things? Is there a Christian worldview on the World Cup? How to lose graciously? Is there a Christian worldview on that? Well, there's all kinds of things to do with idolatry and expectation and hope and achievement. Oh, there's all kinds of things you can talk about to do with the World Cup. And shopping and the economy and politicians. And, of course, the life and death issues that are spoken about. And schools and religious infiltration within schools and fundamentalists who are getting into schools. Islamic fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, all kinds of things that we can talk about with a Christian worldview. But of course, you've got to cultivate a Christian worldview to be able to do that. So engage. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Second point, give to God what is God's. That's the second half of what Jesus says. And of course, that really is overwhelming. What does God deserve? Caesar deserves some degree of tax and respect, perhaps, for being the ruler. But what is due to God? What has Jesus got in mind? Well, I guess if you think of the weight of all the Old Testament scriptures that they would have known up to this point, what does God deserve? A little empire? Of course, God deserves all honor and all praise and all glory is due to him. He deserves eternal thanks and worship and honor. That's what is due to God. So give to God what is due to God. It's quite a neat sort of connection. If you think about it, whose imprint is stamped in the world? Whose image is impressed on the world? Not just on a coin. Whose image is impressed on the world? Well, it's God's image. And particularly on mankind, the image of God. We're made in the image of God, with the imprint of God, whose inscription is across the heavens and the earth. Well, it's God's, isn't it? So give to God what is God's, which is the whole earth, the whole of ourselves. Everything belongs to God. This whole earth belongs to God. So give to God what God deserves. Jesus says the real emperor, God, is the one who brings peace and prosperity. And when emperors demand worship, then they're taking what is due to God. That's the implication of what he's saying. And our obligations to God are supreme. That does give a little warning to us to say, be careful not to put your trust in human rulers. Some politicians might think they're God, even though we don't have the cult of emperor these days. But most of us are probably cynical about politicians in particular. We wouldn't think that they were little gods, only in their own minds. And I don't think we're in danger of worshipping them. But sometimes we do trust in the power of earthly institutions and empires. We do either trust or fear them. And that's giving to them something that they don't deserve, because all power and authority comes from God, not from them. Either we trust in the system or we kind of fear the system, particularly if it's an empire somewhere else that seems to be threatening us in some way. And Jesus says, only give that honor to God. Only give the right of absolute rule, and only give fear absolutely to God. So don't put your trust in human rulers rather than putting your trust in God. And give your whole self to God. Maybe you pay your taxes, but are you paying your due to God? Now, of course, Jesus isn't saying this is all about what you do and you just pay God enough and then God will kind of leave you alone or give you a safe place to live. Of course, there's lots more to say about how we live. But as a matter of attitude and direction, Are you saying, I want to give everything over to God? I want to give all glory and honor to God and to the one God has sent, the Lord Jesus Christ, who does have all authority and power. He is the Son sent from that parable we looked at last week, the Son who is loved by the Father, who is sent with all authority and power, and give to him what he deserves. The Pharisees weren't. The Herodians weren't. Chief priests and scribes and rulers weren't giving honor to God. We need to. And even your allegiance to country is just a part of worshiping God. We give to Caesar what is Caesar's because we give to God what is God's. And we give our whole lives over to God. We've been thinking in our particular summer school track about how we give our work to God and we give our rest time to God. It's the whole of our lives given over to the worship of God. Give to God what is God's. What does God deserve? What is God's due? It's everything. It's all of us. It's the whole of our lives given over to him. And sometimes we are so mean and mealy with our giving. We give to God about as much as we're prepared to give taxes. It's a grudging, legalistic thing. We pay what is due, we think. We fill out our religious tax form and we complete it and we pay what is due or it's taken from us kind of automatically in some way. And we think that's it. And Jesus says, give to God what is God's. And what is that really? It's the whole of our lives. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Give to God what is God's. Everything. Find your rest, find your security in God. Work for God. Rest in God. Give to God what is God's. That's all I want to say from that text. It's a great, incisive piece of teaching. You have to kind of just stand back and admire for a moment. And of course, there are many great things to admire about Jesus. But just in this particular text, you have to admire just the incisive, clear teaching that he brings and say, surely this man brings the wisdom of God to us. And in particular, this evening, it's a wisdom that is really practical to your life through this coming week as you pay your taxes, as you engage with people in society, as you say, I'm doing that all for the glory of God, trying to give to God what is due to him.